Welcome to the Enchanted Library, where we turn the pages of books, beautiful and old, living and magical. It's time to curl up, get cozy, and join us on an adventure. Today we're reading from Beautiful Joe by Margaret Marshall Saunders. Chapter 28, The End of the Cruel Man. In a few days, thanks to Mr. Harry's constant care, the horse and cow were able to walk. It was a mournful procession that came into the yard at Dingley Farm. The hollow-eyed horse and lean cow and funny little thin pig, staggering along in such a shaky fashion. Their hooves were diseased and had partly rotted away, so that they could not walk straight. Though it was only a mile or two from Penhallow to Dingley Farm, they were tired out and dropped down exhausted on their comfortable beds. Miss Laura was so delighted to think they had all lived that she did not know what to do. Her eyes were bright and shining, and she went from one to another for such a happy face. The queer little pig that Mr. Harry christened Daddy Longlegs had been washed, and he lay on his heap of straw in the corner of his neat little pen, and surveyed his clean trough and abundance of food with the air of a prince. Why, he would be clean and dry here, and all his life he had been used to dirty, damp Penhallow, with the trees hanging over him, and his little feet in a mass of filth and dead leaves. Happy little pig! His ugly eyes seemed to blink and gleam with gratitude, and he knew Miss Laura and Mr. Harry as well as I did. His tiny tail was curled so tight it was almost in a knot. Mr. Wood said it was a sign that he was healthy and happy, and when poor Daddy was at Penhallow, he had noticed that his tail hung as limp and loose as the tail of a rat. He came and leaned over the pen with Miss Laura, and had a little talk with her about pigs. He said they were by no means the stupid animals that some people considered them. He had had pigs that were almost as clever as dogs. One little black pig he once sold to a man, away back in the country, had found his way home, through the woods, across the river, up hill and down dale, and he'd been taken to the place with a bag over his head. Mr. Wood said he kept that pig because he knew so much. He said the most knowing pigs he ever saw were Canadian pigs. One time he was having a trip on a sailing vessel, and had anchored in a long, narrow harbor in Canada, where the tide came in with a front 4 or 5 feet high called the Boar. There was a village opposite the place where the ship was anchored, and every day at low tide a number of pigs came down to look for shellfish. Sometimes they went out for half a mile over the mud flats, but always a few minutes before the tide came rushing in, they turned and hurried to the shore. Their instinct warned them that if they stayed any longer, they would be drowned. Mr. Wood had a number of pigs, and after a while Daddy was put in with them, and a fine time he had making friends with the other little grunters. They were often let out in the pasture or orchard, and when they were there, I could always single out Daddy from among them, because he was the smartest. Though he had been brought up in such a miserable way, he soon learned to take very good care of himself at Dingley Farm, and it was amusing to see him when a storm was coming on, running about in a state of great excitement, carrying little bundles of straw in his mouth to make himself a bed. He was a white pig, and was always kept very clean. Mr. Wood said it was wrong to keep pigs dirty. They like to be clean as well as other animals, and if they were kept so, human beings would not get so many diseases from eating their flesh. The cow, poor and happy creature, never so long as she lived on Dingley Farm, lost a strange, melancholy look from her eyes. I have heard it said that some animals forget past unhappiness, and perhaps some of them do. I know I have never forgotten my one miserable year with Jenkins, and I have been a sober, thoughtful dog in consequence, and not playful like some dogs who have never known what it is like to be really unhappy. It always seemed to me that the Penhallow cow was thinking of her poor dead calf, starved to death by her cruel master. She got well herself and came and went with the other cows, seeming happy as they, but often when I watched her standing chewing her cud and looking away in the distance, I could see a difference between her face and the faces of the cows that had always been happy on Dingley Farm. Even the farmhands called her Old Melancholy, and soon she got to be known by that name, or Mel for short. Until she got well, she was put in the cow stable, where Mr. Wood's cows all stood at night upon raised platforms of earth covered over with straw litter, and she was tied with a Dutch halter, so she could lie down and go to sleep when she wanted to. When she got well, she was put out to pasture with the other cows. The horse they named Scrub, because he could never be, under any circumstances, anything but a broken-down, plain-looking animal. He was put into the horse stable in a stall next to Fleetfoot, and as the partition was low, they could look over at each other. In the time, by dint of much doctoring, Scrub's hoofs became clean and sound, and he was able to do some work. Miss Laura petted him a great deal. She often took out apples to the stable, and Fleetfoot would throw up his beautiful head and look reproachfully over the partition at her, for she always stayed longer with Scrub than with him, and Scrub always got the larger share of whatever good thing was going. Poor old Scrub. I think he loved Miss Laura. He was a stupid sort of horse, and always acted as if he were blind. He would run his nose up and down the front of her dress, nip at the buttons, and be very happy if he could get a bit of her watch chain between his strong teeth. If he was in the field, he never seemed to know her until she was right under his pale-colored eyes. Then he would be delighted to see her. He was not blind, though, for Mr. Wood said he was not. He said he had probably not been an overbright horse to start with, and had been made more dull by cruel usage. As for the former master of these animals, a very strange thing happened to him. He came to a terrible end, but for a long time no one knew anything about it. Mr. Wood and Mr. Harry were so very angry with him that they said they would leave no stone unturned to have him punished, or at least have it known what a villain he was. They sent the paper with the crest on it to New York. Someone there found out that it was the crest of a highly esteemed family, who were all honorable people except this one man, who was the black sheep of them all. As a young man, he had led a wild and wicked life, and had ended by forging the name of one of his friends, so he was obliged to leave his home and take refuge in entirely new surroundings. By the description of this man, Mr. Wood knew that he must be Mr. Barron, so he wrote to those people, told them what a wicked thing their relative had done in leaving his animals to starve. In a short time, he got an answer from them, which was very proud and very touching. It came from Mr. Barron's cousin, and he said quite frankly that he knew his relative was a man of evil habits, but it seemed as if nothing could be done to reform him. His family was accustomed to send a quarterly allowance to him, on condition that he lead a quiet life in some retired place, but their last remittance to him was lying unclaimed in Boston, and they thought he must be dead. Could Mr. Wood tell them anything about him? Mr. Wood looked very thoughtful when he got this letter, and then he said, "Harry, how long is it since Barron ran away?" "About 8 weeks," said Mr. Harry. "That's strange," said Mr. Wood. "The money these relatives sent him would get to Boston in just a few days after he left here. He is not the man to leave it long unclaimed. Something must have happened to him. Where do you suppose he would go from Penhallow?" "I have no idea, sir," said Mr. Harry. "And how would he go?" said Mr. Wood. "He did not leave Riverdale Station, because he would have been spotted by some of his creditors." "Perhaps he would cut through the woods to the junction," said Mr. Harry. "Just what he would do," said Mr. Wood, slapping his knee. "I'll be driving over there tomorrow to see Thompson, and I'll make some inquiries." Mr. Harry spoke to his father the next night when he came home, and asked if he had found out anything. "Only this," said Mr. Wood. "There's no one answering to Barron's description who has left Riverdale Junction within a 12-month. He must have struck some other station. We'll let him go. The Lord looks out for fellows like that." "We will look out for him if he ever comes back to Riverdale," said Mr. Harry quietly. All through the village and in the country, it was known what a dastardly trick the man had played, and he would be arrested for cruelty to animals if he dared return. Months passed away, and nothing was heard of him. Late in the autumn, after Miss Laura and I had gone back to Fairport, Mrs. Wood wrote her about the end of the stranger at Penhallow. Some Riverdale lads were beating about the wood, looking for lost cattle, and in their wanderings came to an old stone quarry that had been disused for years. On one side, there was a smooth wall of rock many feet deep. On the other, the ground and rock were broken away, and it was quite easy to get into. They found that, by some means or another, one of their cows had fallen into this deep pit over the steep side of the quarry. Of course, the poor creature was dead, but the boys, out of curiosity, resolved to go down and look at her. They clambered down, found the cow, and to their horror and amazement discovered nearby the skeleton of a man. There was a heavy walking stick by his side, which they recognized as the one that Mr. Barron had carried. He was a drinking man, and perhaps he had taken something that he thought would strengthen him for his morning's walk, but which had, on the contrary, bewildered him and made him lose his way and fall into the quarry. Or he might have started before daybreak, and in the darkness have slipped and fallen down the steep wall of rock. One leg was doubled under him, and if he had not been instantly killed by the fall, he must have been so disabled that he could not move. In that lonely place he would call for help in vain, so he may have perished by the terrible death of starvation, the death he had thought to mete out to his suffering animals. Mrs. Wood said there was never a sermon preached in Riverdale that had the effect that the death of this wicked man had, and it reminded her of a verse in the Bible. He made a pit and digged it, and has fallen into the ditch which he made. Mrs. Wood said that her husband had written about the finding of Mr. Barron's body to his relatives, and had received a letter from them in which they seemed relieved to hear that he was dead. They thanked Mr. Wood for his plain speaking and telling them of their relatives' misdeeds, and said that from all they knew of Mr. Barron's past conduct, his influence would be for evil and not for good, in any place that he chose to live. They were having their money sent from Boston to Mr. Wood, and they wished him to expend it in the way that he thought best fitted to counteract the evil effects of their namesake's doing in Riverdale. When this money came, it amounted to some hundreds of dollars. Mr. Wood would have nothing to do with it. He handed it over to the Band of Mercy, and they formed what they called the Barron Fund, which they drew upon when they wanted money for buying and circulating humane literature. Mrs. Wood said that the fund was being added to, and the children were sending all over the state leaflets and little books which preached the gospel kindness to God's lower creation. A stranger picking up one of them and seeing the name of the wicked man printed on the title page would think he was a friend and benefactor to the Riverdale people, the very opposite of what he gloried in being. Chapter 29. Our Return Home. In October, the most beautiful of all the months, we were obliged to go back to Fairport. Miss Laura could not bear to leave the farm, and her face got very sorrowful when anyone spoke of her going away. Still, she had grown well and strong, and was as brown as a berry, and she said that she knew she ought to go home and get back to her lessons. Mr. Wood called October the golden month. Everything was quiet and still, and at night and in the morning the sun had a yellow, misty look. The trees in the orchard were loaded with fruit, and some of the leaves were floating down, making a soft covering on the ground. In the garden there were a great many flowers in bloom, in flaming red and yellow colors. Miss Laura gathered bunches of them every day to put in the parlor. One day, when she was arranging them, she said regretfully, "They will soon be gone. I wish it could always be summer." "You would get tired of it," said Mr. Harry, who had come up softly behind her. "There's only one place where we could stand perpetual summer, and that's in heaven." "Do you suppose it will always be summer there?" said Miss Laura, turning around and looking at him. "I don't know. I imagine it will be, but I don't think anybody knows much about it. We've got to wait." Miss Laura's eyes fell on me. "Harry," she said, "do you think that dumb animals will go to heaven?" "I shall have to say again, I don't know," he replied. "Some people hold that they do. In a Michigan paper the other day, I came across one writer's opinion on the subject. He says that among the best people of all ages have been some who believed in the future life of animals. Homer and the later Greeks, some of the Romans and early Christians held this view, the last believing that God sent angels in the shapes of birds and beasts to his brothers." Dr. Johnson believed in a future life for animals, as did Wordsworth, Shelley, Coleridge, Jeremy Taylor, Agassiz, Lamartine, and many Christian scholars. It seems that they ought to have some compensation for their terrible sufferings in this world. Then, to go to heaven, animals would only have to take up the thread of their lives here. Man is a god to the lower creation. Joe worships you as much as you worship your maker. Dumb animals live in and for their masters. They hang on our words and our looks and are dependent on us in almost every way. For my own part, and looking at it from an earthly point of view, I wish with all my heart that we may find our dumb friends in paradise." "And in the Bible," said Miss Laura, "animals are often spoken of. the dove and the raven, the wolf and the lamb and the leopard and the cattle that God says are his, and the little sparrow that can't fall to the ground without our father's knowing it. Still, there's nothing definite about their immortality, said Mr. Harry. However, we have nothing to do with that. If it's right for them to be in heaven, we'll find them there. All we have to do is to deal with the present, and the Bible plainly tells us that a righteous man regardeth the life of his beast. I think I should be happier in heaven if dear old Joe were there, said Miss Laura, looking wistfully at me. He has been such a good dog. Just think how he has loved and protected me. I think I should be lonely without him. That reminds me of some poetry, or rather doggerel, said Mr. Harry, that I cut out of a newspaper for you yesterday. And he drew from his pocket a little slip of paper and read this. Do doggies gang to heaven, Dad? Will o'er all Donald gang? For no to take him father with us, would he maist awful rang. There were other verses, telling how many kind old things old Donald the dog had done for his master's family. And then it was closed with these lines. Without our dogs, aye, father man, 'twould be an awful sin to leave our faithful doggie there. He's certain to win in. Our Donald's no like other dogs. He no be locked out. If Donald's no let into heaven, I'll no gang there 1 foot. My sentiments exactly, said a merry voice behind Miss Laura and Mr. Harry. And looking up, they saw Mr. Maxwell. He was holding out one hand to them, and in the other kept back a basket of large pears that Mr. Harry promptly took from him and offered to Miss Laura. I've been dependent upon animals for the most part of my comfort in this life, said Mr. Maxwell, and I shan't be happy without them in heaven. I don't see how you would get on without Joe, Miss Morris. And I want my birds and my snake and my horse. How can I live without them? They're almost all my life here. If some animals go to heaven and not others, I think the dog has the first claim, said Miss Laura. He's the friend of man, the oldest and best. Have you ever heard the legend about him and Adam? No, said Mr. Maxwell. Well, when Adam was turned out of paradise, all the animals shunned him, and he sat weeping bitterly with his head between his hands, when he felt the soft tongue of some creature gently touching him. He took his hands from his face, and there was a dog that had separated himself from all the other animals and was trying to comfort him. He became the chosen friend and companion of Adam, and afterward of all men. There is another legend, said Mr. Harry, about our Savior and a dog. Have you ever heard it? We'll tell you that later, said Mr. Maxwell, when we know what it is. Mr. Harry showed his white teeth in an amused smile and began, Once upon a time, our Lord was going through a town with his disciples. A dead dog lay by the wayside, and everyone that passed along flung some offensive epithet at him. Eastern dogs are not like our dogs, and seemingly there was nothing good about this loathsome creature. But as our Savior went by, he said gently, Pearls cannot equal the whiteness of his teeth. What was the name of that old fellow, said Mr. Maxwell abruptly, who had a beautiful swan that came every day for 15 years to bury his head in his bosom and feed from his hand, and would go near no other human being? St. Hugh of Lincoln. We heard about him at the Band of Mercy the other day, said Miss Laura. I should think that he would have wanted to have that swan in heaven with him, said Mr. Maxwell. What a beautiful creature it must have been. Speaking about animals going to heaven, I dare say some of them would object to going, on account of the company they would meet there. Think of the dog kicked to death by his master, the horse driven into his grave, the thousands of cattle starved to death on the plains. Will they want to meet their owners in heaven? According to my reckoning, their owners won't be there, said Mr. Harry. I firmly believe the Lord will punish every man or woman who ill-treats a dumb creature, just as surely as he will punish those who ill-treat their fellow creatures. If a man's life has been a long series of cruelty to dumb animals, do you suppose he would enjoy himself in heaven, which will be full of kindness to everyone? Not he. He'd rather be in another place, and there he'll go, I fully believe. When you've quite disposed of all your fellow creatures and the dumb creation, Harry, perhaps you will condescend to go out in the orchard and see how your father is getting on with picking the apples, said Mrs. Wood, joining Miss Laura and the two men, her eyes twinkling and sparkling with amusement. The apples will keep, Mother, said Mr. Harry, putting his arm around her. I just came in for a moment to get Laura. Come, Maxwell, we'll all go. And not another word about animals, Mrs. Wood called after them. Laura will go crazy someday through thinking of their sufferings if someone doesn't do something to stop her. Miss Laura turned around suddenly. Dear Aunt Hattie, she said, you must not say that. I am a coward, I know, about hearing of animals' pains, but I must get over it. I want to know how they suffer. I ought to know, for when I get to be a woman, I am going to do all I can to help them. And I'll join you, said Mr. Maxwell, stretching out his hand to Miss Laura. She did not smile, but looking very earnestly at him, she held it clasped in her own. You will help me care for them, will you? She said. Yes, I promise, he said gravely. I'll give myself to the service of dumb animals, if you will. And I, too, said Mr. Harry in his deep voice, laying his hand across theirs. Mrs. Wood stood there looking at their three fresh, eager young faces with tears in her eyes. Just as they all stood silently for an instant, the old village clergyman came into the room from the hall. He must have heard what they said, for before they could move, he had laid his hands on their three brown heads. "Bless you, my children," he said. "God will lift up the light of his countenance upon you, for you have given yourselves to a noble work. In serving dumb creatures, you are ennobling the human race." Then he sat down in a chair and looked at them. He was a venerable old man and had long white hair, and the Woods thought a great deal of him. He had come to get Mrs. Wood to make some nourishing dishes for a sick woman in the village, and while he was talking to her, Miss Laura and the two young men went out of the house. They hurried across the veranda and over the lawn, talking and laughing and enjoying themselves as only happy young people can, without a trace of the seriousness of a few moments before. They were going so fast that they ran right into a flock of geese coming up the lane. They were driven by a little boy called Tommy, the son of one of Mr. Wood's farm laborers, and they were chattering and gabbling and seemed very angry. "What's all this about?" said Mr. Harry, stopping and looking at the boy. "What's the matter with your feathered charges, Tommy, my lad?" "If it's the geese, you mean," said the boy, half crying and looking very much put out. "It's all them nasty potatoes. They won't keep away from them." "So the potatoes chase the geese, do they?" said Mr. Maxwell teasingly. "No, no," said the child pettishly. "Mr. Wood, he sets me to watch the geese, and they runs in among the buckwheat and the potatoes, and I try to drive them out, and they doesn't want to come. And," shamefacedly, "I had to switch their feet, and I hate to do it, 'cause I'm a Band of Mercy boy." "Tommy, my son," said Mr. Maxwell solemnly, "you will go right to heaven when you die, and your geese will go with you." "Hush, hush," said Miss Laura. "Don't tease him." And putting her arm on the child's shoulder, she said, "You are a good boy, Tommy, not to want to hurt the geese. Let me see your switch, dear." He showed her a little stick he had in his hand, and she said, "I don't think you could hurt them much with that. And if they will be naughty and steal the potatoes, you have to drive them out. Take some of my pears and eat them, and you will forget your trouble." The child took the fruit, and Miss Laura and the two young men went on their way smiling and looking over their shoulders at Tommy, who stood in the middle of the lane, devouring his pears and keeping one eye on the geese that had gathered a little in front of him. They were gabbling noisily and having kind of an indignation meeting because they had been driven out of the potato field. Tommy's father and mother lived in a little house down near the road. Mr. Wood never had his hired men live in his own house. He had two small houses for them, and they were required to keep them as neat as Mr. Wood's own house was kept. He said he didn't see why he should keep a boarding house if he was a farmer, nor why his wife should wear herself out waiting on strong, hardy men that had just as soon take care of themselves. He wished to have his own family about him, and that was better for his men to have some kind of family life for themselves. If one of his men was unmarried, he boarded with the married one, but slept in his own house. On this October day, we found Mr. Wood hard at work under the fruit trees. He had a good many different kinds of apples, enormous red ones and long yellow ones they called pippins, and little brown ones and smooth-coated sweet ones and bright red ones and others, more than I can mention. Miss Laura often pared one and cut off little bits for me, for I always wanted to eat whatever I saw her eating. Just a few days after this, Miss Laura and I returned to Fairport, and some of Mr. Wood's apples traveled along with us, for he sent a good many to the Boston market. Mr. and Mrs. Wood came to the station to see us off. Mr. Harry could not come, for he had left Riverdale the day before to go back to his college. Mrs. Wood said she would be very lonely without her two young people, and she kissed Miss Laura over and over again and made her promise to come back again the next summer. I was put in a box in the express car, and Mr. Wood told the agent that if he knew what was good for him, he would speak to me occasionally, for I was a very knowing dog, and if he didn't treat me well, I'd be apt to write him up in the newspapers. The agent laughed, and quite often on the way to Fairport, he came to my box and spoke kindly to me, so I did not get so lonely and frightened as I did on my unhappy journey to Riverdale. How glad the Morrises were to see us coming back. The boys had all arrived home before us, and such a fuss they did make over their sister. They loved her dearly and never wanted her to be long away from them. I was rubbed and stroked and had to run about offering my paw to everyone. Jim and little Billy licked my face, and Bella croaked a new sentence they had taught her. Glad to see you, Joe. Had a good time? How's your health? We soon settled down for the winter. Miss Laura began going to school and came home every day with a pile of books under her arm. The summer in the country had done her so much good that her mother often looked at her fondly and said the white-faced child she sent away had come home a nut-brown maid. Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed today's episode, please leave a review on your favorite podcast platform and share our podcast with a friend. Visit our website at www.enchantedlibrary.net to see our past books or to connect with us on Facebook. If you'd like to support the work we do, you can visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/enchantedlibrary. We appreciate your support. Until next time, friends, happy reading.